p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. This week, author and political commentator Michael Barone examines the writings and observations of the 19th century French aristocrat Alexis de Tocqueville, focusing on de Tocqueville's conceptions of liberty, equality, and community. Tocqueville is best known for his two-volume work, Democracy in America, based on his travels around America in the 1830s. Mr. Barone was a guest lecturer at the Citadel Military College in Charleston, South Carolina, in a course called The Conservative Intellectual Tradition in America, taught by Professor Mallory Factor. This is just under 2 hours.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, and a special honor to be asked to speak on the fragility of ordered liberty and to speak on Alexis de Tocqueville. And in rereading Tocqueville in preparation for this lecture, I began to think that he was something like Mozart, that I was in the presence of a mind that was so far above the level of almost anyone else in history that he almost brooks no comparison with anybody else. You can listen to the music of Mozart, and it sounds pleasant and melodic and so forth. But if you really think about it, if you really kind of analyze it, you realize that he's doing things no one else had ever done or was capable of doing, that it's so far above the level of ordinary, even impressive achievement, that you're in the presence of something rare. And I think you see the same thing with Tocqueville. It's easy to read Tocqueville fairly fast. You're in front of a television set, there's a conversation in the next room, you're starting to think about what you have to do an hour from now and what you have to pick up at the store. And you lose the track of the fact that Tocqueville really requires close attention. And when you pay him that close attention, you realize that you're in the presence of somebody extraordinary. And what is interesting about this parallel is that both of these men did their great work as young men. It's a little daunting, perhaps even to a college audience, that Mozart died at age 35, so all that we have from him was written from the time he started composing music at age 6 until his death at age 35. Tocqueville composed the two volumes of Democracy in America by the time he was 35. He did other great work later, but if he had died at age 35 on the publication of the second volume of Democracy in America at that same age that Mozart died, I think we would still know that he was a great man and that he was way above the ordinary level of human achievement, that he has much to teach us today. So let me begin by recalling that on the 11th day of May, 1831, two young French aristocrats, Alexis de Tocqueville and his friend Gustave Beaumont, arrived in Newport, Rhode Island, on their way to New York after sailing 38 days from France. They were lawyers with a commission from the French government to study American prisons, which they did. But they did much more, for during the course of his 288 days of travels in the young republic, Tocqueville, who was only 25 years old when he landed, not much older than today's undergraduates, made the observations and accumulated the material which he fashioned in the two volumes of Democracy in America, which the political scientist and Tocqueville translator Harvey Mansfield has called the best book ever written on democracy and the best book ever written on America. He conversed with President Andrew Jackson at a reception in the White House, sat next to former President John Quincy Adams at dinner in Boston. He was escorted around Washington by Joel Poinsett, the Charleston-born botanist and future Secretary of War, and by Edward Everett, the Boston-born lawyer and future Secretary of State. He met 95-year-old Charles Carroll, the last surviving signer of the Declaration of Independence and the only Catholic to sign that document, and Sam Houston, the future president of the Republic of Texas. He attended town meetings in New England, observed slave markets in the South. He visited Indian villages in the Michigan Territory, voyaged on steamboats that shortly after he disembarked blew up. It was a highly hazardous form of transportation. He traveled by stagecoach. He went to Columbia, South Carolina. He did not, unfortunately for himself, make it to Charleston. Tocqueville was an aristocrat whose family suffered during the French Revolution. They could trace their heritage back to Norman times, the invasion of William the Conqueror. Some of his ancestors were part of that army. His great-grandfather, Malazar, a distinguished philosopher and lawyer, who was defense counsel in the trial of King Louis XVI, was guillotined months after his client. Tocqueville's father escaped the guillotine only because of the fall of Robespierre 3 days before he was scheduled to be guillotined as well. And when he left the prison at age 22, his hair had turned completely white. This was a family that was traumatized by this great event in history, the French Revolution. As a child, Tocqueville was born in 1805, met the restored King Louis XVIII after the downfall of Napoleon. And while he and his family thrived under Louis, his brother Charles X, and the new bourgeois King Louis Philippe, the specter of bloodshed and tumult of the revolution, the threat of another revolution, was always in their thoughts. And he came from a background which considered the French Revolution a great disaster. In the first lecture in this course, Alfred Regnery recounted how the ideas of American conservatism had roots in four cities: Jerusalem, Athens, Rome, and London. Conspicuously absent from this list is Paris, still ruled by a monarch and a centralized bureaucracy with limited powers to a legislature whose members were chosen by a very small electorate. Tocqueville knew before his arrival that America was different. It was something that he wanted to see, that it was a democracy, the word he used in his title. And it was democracy was something that the people in whose circles he lived and his family in which he'd grown up regarded with dread. The young republic had evolved in important ways from the days of the founders. Revolutionary America was still a somewhat deferential society, not an aristocratic society like Europe, but a deferential society. And at the time of the Constitution, most states allowed only those with a certain amount of property to vote. That's why the framers of the Constitution provided that the House of the Representatives should be chosen by the same electorate that chose the most numerous house in the state legislature. That would be as wide a franchise, but not a complete franchise, of all adult male citizens. It was considered dangerous in the British tradition and the American tradition to allow those without property, without a stake in society, to be in a position to determine the course of government. And this is indeed a tradition that comes to us as well from Athens and Rome, where they also felt that the property, people with a stake in society, should have a monopoly on political power and on the vote. But in the first decades of the Republic, as historian Gordon Wood has written, American society became less deferential and more democratic in character. Tocqueville was struck when former President Adams was treated as just another guest at dinner, and he notes in his letters home that he's surprised that he wasn't treated like a monarch. People didn't bow down before him, but simply said hello. By the 1830s, almost all the states, South Carolina was an exception, had extended the vote to all white adult males. Some still resisted, as John Randolph of Roanoke did at Virginia's Constitutional Convention, decrying, quote, the all-prevailing principle that numbers and numbers alone are to regulate all things in political society, and the prospect that government was to divorce property from power. He believed that they should be connected and not divorced. But by the time Tocqueville arrived, this was a minority view in Virginia as elsewhere. To most legislators, universal suffrage, limited to adult white males. We obviously do not limit it to whites and to males anymore. We still limit it to adults. The full universal suffrage did not seem so dangerous in a nation where the large majority of people were farmers who owned their own land and who therefore were property holders. For the French aristocrats in Tocqueville's time, however, with their still vibrant dread of the French Revolution, democracy still seemed very dangerous indeed. Tocqueville disagreed, seeing dangers in democracy, but also seeing opportunities and reasons for hope. And he also saw democracy as irresistible, as the wave of the future, as something that was sure to come in some form, good or bad, to Europe, where it would be in conflict with the aristocratic heritage, as it had come into America, which did not have much in the way of an aristocratic heritage to conflict with it. One danger that Tocqueville perceived in democracy was what he called individualism the tendency of citizens to isolate themselves and withdraw from the larger society when they're not bound together by the relations between aristocrats and their inferiors. The model he had in mind was the Normandy of his, where his family had resided and held property and been ennobled for centuries, where they had obligations to people that lived on their land and people in the vicinity and institutions there, and where the people in turn had obligations to people like the Tocquevilles. They were connected, he thought. They were not equal, but those connections at least existed. And he was afraid that in a democratic society, in a society where all were considered equal, that those relationships would not appear and that they would be replaced by individualism, by the isolation of the individual and not having the connections, the social connections with others. Democracy, he wrote, threatens to confine the citizen so wholly in the solitude of his own heart. But the America, he observed, avoided this danger, he came to believe, because of two important factors. The Americans, he wrote, have combated the individualism to which equality gives birth with freedom, and they have defeated it. He saw this as a very hopeful development. And you can read much of Tocqueville as an instruction to his French relatives and contemporaries about how this system that they were very suspicious of, in fact, was working pretty well, and that the dangers they thought it contained had been avoided. And one of those dangers that had been avoided was individualism. One of the things that helped them avoid that danger was the importance of government and of local governments. At the time of his visit, Americans seldom came into contact with the federal government, with the single exception of the post office. And even that was not always federally ruled. In the decades after Tocqueville came to the United States, postmasters in South Carolina would not transmit abolitionist letters and literature. They simply burned it or destroyed it and would not deliver it to the recipients. But the post office was the main source of federal power. But Americans were of necessity in constant contact with local governments, with the towns of New England, the townships that were spread across the old Northwest Territory, the counties in the South, and being affected by their decisions took advantage of the opportunity to participate in it. Democracy meant that those decisions by local governments were not made simply by those above them, but made by them and people that they chose. Thus, by charging citizens with the administration of small affairs, much more than by leaving government the government of great ones to them, writes Tocqueville, one interests them in the public good and makes them see the need they constantly have for one another in order to produce it. Local freedoms bring men closer to one another. Local freedoms and democracies bring people into contact and establish ties and bonds between them on the basis of equality that were equivalent to or better than the ties that were created between them in the unequal system of aristocracy. And what we see here is an appreciation of the conservative principle which Catholic philosophers refer to as subsidiarity. Instead of a central government superintending local affairs, as was the case in France, and that began, as Tocqueville wrote in his later volume on the Ancien Régime and the French Revolution, well before the French Revolution, with the centralizing impulse of Louis XIV, getting rid of local governments and local autonomy, centralizing authority in the king, as Louis XIV once said, "L'État, c'est moi." The state, it's me. I am the government. That France was centralized before the revolution becomes further centralized by the revolution, which abolishes the ancient provinces and creates the départements, where the superintendents are appointed by the central government in Paris, usually from a list of people as time went on who were educated in certain central universities in Paris. And in fact, government in France still resembles that model in very many ways. That kind of centralization did not, in Tocqueville's view, was something that for which he had a considerable dread. And he notes that instead of having that kind of central government, democracy in America tended to let local governments, chosen by people who would remain close to their representatives, and be affected by their decisions, have control of all matters that could be handled at that level. The Constitution limited the powers of the federal government. Tocqueville studies intensely the different features of the Constitution and reserved other matters to the state governments and the people. And the state governments in turn delegated to local matters which could be addressed locally. Now, not every issue could be so delegated, Tocqueville realized. One of the major events during his visit was the nullification crisis, in which the South Carolina legislature, encouraged by Vice President John C. Calhoun, South Carolinian, declared that it had the right to nullify a tariff law passed by Congress. President Andrew Jackson reacted furiously, he was not fond of his vice president at all, and he moved troops in place to enforce the law outside South Carolina, while at the same time moving Congress toward a compromise position on the tariff, which addressed some of South Carolina's grievances. Tocqueville described some of this process in Democracy in America. Tocqueville also coincided with another national policy that had a significant regional effect, and that was Andrew Jackson's Indian removal policy, something he considered very important. The forced movement of what we now call the Five Civilized Tribes over what has come to be called the Trail of Tears from the southeastern states to what is now Oklahoma. And Tocqueville, on his western travels, actually witnessed some of the Indians moving west in this movement. And he wrote a chapter at the end of the first volume of Democracy in America on the position of Indians and blacks in America and what the problems that posed for the country. These issues foreshadowed crises that came later and illustrated problems which Tocqueville addressed in the last chapters of the first volume of Democracy in America. On the fact that blacks and Indians were not considered citizens in this democratic republic. He foresaw the possibility of the rupture of the Civil War. It's one of his many uncanny predictions. He looks ahead, this young man writing in his 20s and 30s, looks ahead and sees much of the future history that has happened. He sees the possibility of the rupture of Civil War and the tragic fate of many Native Americans, even as he saluted the way democracy bound citizens together through local government. And perhaps he may even be seen as having pointed to the successes of the civil rights movement when he writes, "To combat the evils that equality can produce, there is only one efficacious remedy. It is political freedom." But the habits of the heart, another Tocqueville phrase, fostered by involvement in local government, also did something else. And here we encounter the second reason Americans avoided the isolationism of the individual, or what Tocqueville calls individualism. And incidentally, I gather that that was his use of the term individualism is one of the first times that word enters the French and English languages. He coins words as well as ideas that had occurred to no one before. To the contrary, Americans were busy starting thousands of voluntary associations, of creating civil society, mediating institutions between individuals and government, institutions through which individuals could affect government or could change society without involving government at all. And Tocqueville paints this, one passage, he paints this picture of a busy people constantly involved in political activity and voluntary associations. "Scarcely have you descended on that on the soil of America," he writes, "when you find yourself in the midst of a sort of turmoil. A confused clamor is raised on all sides. A thousand voices come to your ears at the same time, each of them expressing some social needs." And I think some of his French aristocratic readers are here kind of saying, "Oh, doesn't sound good here. This is a problem, all these people agitating. Around you, everything moves. Here, the people of one neighborhood have gathered to learn if a church ought to be built. There, they are working on the choice of a representative. Farther on, the deputies of a district are going to town in all haste in order to decide about some local improvements. In another place, the farmers of a village abandon their furrows to go discuss the plan of a road or school. Citizens assemble with the sole goal of declaring that they disapprove of the course of government, whereas others gather to proclaim that the men in place are the fathers of their country. Here are others still who, regarding drunkenness as the principal source of the evils of the state, come solemnly to pledge themselves to give an example of temperance." There is a note of astonishment here, I think, and particularly in that last sentence where the wine-drinking French aristocrat contemplates the possibilities of the prohibition of alcohol. Tocqueville, Tocqueville arrived in America at a time when voluntary associations were championing causes that ultimately transformed the nation, and often involving government, but often not involving government, often changing people's the habits of the heart. They were particularly common, these associations, in New England, in upstate New York, which had been settled by New England Yankees, where Tocqueville spent a large part of his visit. Nearly half of his visit was in that northern tier of states. The Yankee, as Orestes Brownson noted, tends to be, quote, restless in body and mind, always scheming, always in motion, never satisfied with what he has, and always seeking to make the world like himself or as uneasy as himself. And David Hackett Fisher, the great historian, author of Albion's Seed, Four British Folkways Made Their Way from the British Isles to the Different American Colonies, notes that the New Englanders tended, who were isolated in their own colonies for 200 years and then spread across the northern part of the country, they were moralistic and intolerant. They believed in following their moral principles and in making other people do it too, persuading them if possible, but using powers of government if indeed. Tocqueville clearly admired, on balance, the reformist Yankee impulse as an advantage, example of democratic Americans working together in voluntary associations to improve their society. One of these efforts, as he notes, was the temperance movement, which ultimately persuaded the nation to embark on a dozen years of the noble experiment of prohibiting alcohol. That experiment failed, but in Tocqueville's time, the temperance movement did vastly reduce alcohol consumption by something like two-thirds average alcohol consumption in this country. In what one historian, speaking of the period before which Tocqueville arrived, entitled a book, The Alcoholic Republic, the consumption of whiskey was very high, and there is not a total lack of correlation with the average consumption of whiskey and the number of duels that people were participating in. This was a pretty lusty and go-get-em society, and the temperance movement had a big effect on the behavior of Americans. Another movement that was soon to begin was the women's rights movement, which resulted in another amendment to the Constitution granting women the vote. Tocqueville, the Frenchman, whose wife, by the way, was English, French attitudes, Tocqueville was astonished to note that, quote, women themselves often go to political assemblies and by listening to political discourses take a rest from household tedium. We're now in a period in our history where, to take one example, Hillary Clinton is doing something other than taking a rest from household tedium. She's serving as two women recently before has served as Secretary of State. But Tocqueville sees this movement. I'm not sure that he entirely approves, but he observes it. He sees something. This is not something in France, in aristocratic France, women could exercise a behind-the-scenes influence in the boudoir, but they were not seen in the course of formal public debate. America was something different. Another movement that was beginning to gain adherence was abolitionism, the move to abolish slavery, and the increasing defense of slavery by white Southerners. Just a few years before Tocqueville's journey, a state constitutional convention in Virginia, I've referenced John Randolph Roanoke's remarks at that convention, had narrowly rejected a provision to gradually abolish slavery, as all the states geographically to the north had done. And it's tantalizing to contemplate how history would have unfolded if that decision had gone the other way. In the North, most Americans considered abolitionist fanatics who would disrupt the Union, 1830s. They were considered extremists. But the abolitionist cause had great moral power in a nation whose Declaration of Independence had begun with the words, "We hold it to be self-evident that all men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." And there was also a tension between the existence of slavery and the moral equality in Christianity professed by almost all Americans. Christianity is a religion unlike the pagan religions which it replaced, which says that each individual has an immortal soul and is made in the image of God. This would have been an absolutely astonishing proposition to Aristotle, to the Roman philosophers, but it was part of the Christian heritage of America, and it was always in some tension with slavery. And one of the interesting things about Britain and America is that the impulse to end first the slave trade and then slavery itself was an impulse that was strongest in, most strongly advocated by, evangelical Christians of the day and Quakers. It came out of religious belief. Those who see religious conservatives or religious people of any ideological disposition as a threat to democracy need to reflect on the fact that the movement to abolish slavery was a movement that began, as indeed much of the civil rights movement began, as a movement spurred by people with strong Christian impulses and that were at peace with some of the tenets that are at the heart of Christianity. And religion clearly impressed Tocqueville. He was from a country, France, in which everybody was technically Catholic but had gone through a revolution that was secular and anti-religious, where in the wake of that revolution, the Catholic Church had become an ally of the royal family instead of a kind of adversary to it as it had been in the pre-revolutionary period, and in which the church, Catholic Church, nationally, internationally, in the form of the papacy, was explicitly hostile to democracy. Said that it was not a good system. So religion from Tocqueville, in Tocqueville's, from the perspective of the people among whom he had grown up, religion was the enemy of democracy. Tocqueville writes, "On my arrival in the country, it was the religious aspect of the country that first struck my eye. In contrast to the countries with established churches and with monopolies of religious belief established by law or enforced by the state," Tocqueville notes the spirit, in those situations, he said, the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom almost always move in contrary directions. But Americans had a different heritage. Britain's North American colonies started off with different religious traditions. Some of them were havens of people who were subject to religious persecution, including the Huguenots who settled in South Carolina after King Louis XIV revoked the Edict of Nantes and said that the Protestants would not be tolerated in his country. The founders who understood this multivarious religious heritage provided in the Constitution there be no religious test for office in the federal government. And in the Bill of Rights, they provided that Congress shall make no law regarding an establishment of religion, nor one prohibiting the free exercise thereof. This didn't mean an entire separation of church and state, although Tocqueville uses that phrase. During his visit to Massachusetts, still had an established church, which it supported by the taxing power, tax revenues of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. That was abolished a couple of years later. But Tocqueville noted the paradox that, again, I think was something that he thought would astonish his French aristocratic readers. Diminishing the apparent force of a religion came to increase its real power. If people were not forced to attend and financially support a church, they would have more adherence to the church which they voluntarily supported, and its teachings would mean more to them. Tocqueville believed that religious belief was more prevalent and stronger in America than in France, and that Americans believe it necessary to the maintenance of republican institutions. So in his view, religion was not hostile to democracy and the republic. It was the friend and the support of democracy and the republic. Religion, he writes, which among Americans never mixes directly in the government, should therefore be considered as the first of their political institutions. For if it does not give them the taste for freedom, it singularly facilitates their use of it. Religious belief, he could observe, was the impulse behind the movements for temperance and women's rights and abolition of slavery. It was an impulse which gave strength to the observation of limits of the powers on the state. And indeed, we're just debating in our politics of today an issue involving what power should the state have over the free exercise of religious beliefs by individuals and by organizations they establish to work together, which have a religious basis. It gave strength. Religion gives strength to the observation of the limits of power on the state and the limits on the power of temporary voting majorities. At the same time that the law permits the American people to do everything, Tocqueville writes, religion prevents them from conceiving everything and forbids them to dare anything. So instead of having external state limitations, you have individual self-restraint and group self-restraint through groups in which people voluntarily associate. Religions could produce movements that could be described as liberal or liberating, but it also fostered a stubborn conservatism that would prevent the excesses and the despotism produced by the anti-religious French Revolution, with its bloody executions and its defiance of due process of law. Tocqueville also saw that religion and law also combined to produce material prosperity, another conservatizing effect, if you will, of the American system. One is astonished by the growing prosperity of the people, he writes at one point. In the two decades before Tocqueville's visit, Americans had been building canals. He traveled on a number of them. And just before he arrived, the first tracks of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad were being laid down. Steamboats were plying the Mississippi River with disastrous safety records, as he noted. Mark Twain and Life on the Mississippi gives you an idea what those were like a couple of decades later. Travel times and transportation costs were being hugely reduced, and internal trade hugely increased. It's hard to overestimate the difference that it made. I mean, New York was closer in travel time to Europe than it was to my home state of Michigan before the completion of the Erie Canal. After the Erie Canal and lake travel, steamboat travel through Lake Erie, goods produced in Michigan can be transported to New York, where they can be disseminated around the East Coast into different domestic markets or shipped abroad at hugely decreased costs. So you're spreading capitalist economic activity across the country, and the internal trade in the country is hugely increased. The frontier farmers are no longer living in a situation where they can expect to be totally self-sufficient in goods and services their whole lives. They're being part of an economy that's being knit together. At the same time, American merchants were plying the Atlantic, carrying on the China trade. American whaling vessels were pursuing their prey in the South Pacific. You can read Melville's wonderful Moby Dick about that, and don't skip the whale chapters. They're actually kind of interesting about that. That travel, you know, we have an image from some 20th century political rhetoric that Americans before World War I or World War II, at some point in the early 20th century, that Americans before that were isolationists, were penned up in their own country. That simply isn't true. What you saw were you had merchant ties all over the world, and some of these were immensely profitable. I mean, Sarah Delano Roosevelt, the mother of President Franklin Roosevelt, her father, Warren Delano, made two China voyages in the China trade, and sometime not much longer after Tocqueville came to America. He retired after that at the age of 31 and built a castle on the Hudson River. And the family was rich ever since off the profits from that kind of trade. That was America traveling around the world. And in the decades after Tocqueville, it starts about his time, you also have American churches sending missionaries around the world. Hawaii was annexed by the United States in 1898, but the missionaries were there in the 1820s. And so the religious impulse which Tocqueville traces in America is one that America is also tracing in the world. And so that Tocqueville doesn't, I believe, mention this development. This is the kind of activity, the hyperactivity that this country is producing, this country with its multiple religions, its very thin federal government, its strong belief in its increasing transportation and communication as the telegraph comes in the 1840s, and its ability to basically cut space and time in half. So this buzzing activity that Tocqueville is describing in America is also penetrating in various ways around the world. Within the country, Americans are moving westward in vast numbers. They're creating new Englands, and they've done so in upstate New York, in northeast Ohio, in Michigan, where Tocqueville was there when it was the Michigan Territory, scarcely settled 10 years later. It was a state 6 years later, and filled up with largely with New England Yankee stock people from upstate New York. You had Pennsylvanians going sort of directly west from Philadelphia. So they go to Cincinnati, where if you look at the downtown street grid and adjust it to the side, you will see that the street names are almost exactly the same as Center City, Philadelphia. They've copied the street grid. And the accent, local accent in Cincinnati, to the extent it persists, is very much like the local accent in Philadelphia. They sort of say, oot instead of oat and things, and so forth. They're going directly. The New England Yankees are very much setting up these voluntary associations, making a lot of noise, moralistic. The Philadelphians, coming kind of from the Quaker tradition, are more quiet. They're tolerant of corruption outside their own circle, but they insist on moral behavior within it. They're part of the anti-slavery movement, too. And in the South, you've got the great movement of slaveholders and of the slaves themselves across from the Atlantic states. Virginia becomes a state exporting slaves in large number. South Carolina, many of the great planters in South Carolina are buying plantation land from which the Indians have been expelled recently in Alabama and Mississippi, and building huge plantations, so that Charleston in many ways is the richest significant city and per capita wealth, at least of the free population at the time of the beginning of the Civil War, and the richest colony county in the United States by that measure is Adams County, Mississippi, which the county seat is Natchez on the Mississippi, cotton lands on the Mississippi River. This is a westward migration for the slaves. For the African Americans, that migration involved really more people than moving people across the Atlantic, and it was also a huge trauma. I mean, slaves were taken, families were taken apart, they were taken away from their churches, where, you know, the authentic, which are, you know, the kind of worship that you can hear in Black American churches today, I think, is one of our closest connections with how people actually lived in the 18th century. It's a tradition that's been carried on for a long time with a hugely strong musical tradition, which has been related in our popular music. But you also had this sort of huge trauma of people being moved across the country in a variety of ways. Tocqueville saw the slave market in New Orleans. He saw this stuff that was going on. As I say, he was concerned about it. And at the same time, he could hardly not but be impressed by the huge economic growth, by the bustle and change, by the vigor of this somewhat disorganized, very much decentralized, but also vital and free and productive country. And he was eerily prescient about the future. As I said, he foresaw the possibility of civil war, but he thought the North could not subdue a South based on bent on independence. Which I, you know, as I look back, was probably true when he wrote, since the North's victory 30 years later depended on the industrialization and the vast population growth that occurred between his time and the Civil War, between 1831 and 1861. Tocqueville mused in one of his last chapters in Volume 1 about the possibility that the world in the 20th century would be dominated by two great powers, one democratic and one despotic, America and Russia. Hit the spot again, didn't he? He foresaw that a democratic nation could descend into what he called a soft despotism. In that, he think he anticipated the conservative critique of many of the public policies of the last 100 years. And it's about this critique and Tocqueville's thing that I want to speak about now. Tocqueville's vivid picture of soft despotism appears almost abruptly at the end of the second volume of Democracy in America. The picture he has painted up to that point is a picture of a democratic America is not entirely complimentary. He takes it for granted that democratic America cannot produce the high culture or fine arts fostered by aristocratic nations like France, which is Oh, it was certainly true in the 19th century, with all due regard for our artists and writers, who we did have some pretty good ones, but people are still buying Louis Vuitton luggage and, you know, Chanel perfume and things. France does have that sort of high arts knack for that that was there. He says more generally that a democratic society is less likely than an aristocratic one to value excellence, more likely to tolerate mediocrity. Maybe so. He thinks democracy is more benign in America than it would be in France because it's not the product of a violent revolution which leaves classes divided against each other, but rather springs naturally from a society that was never very aristocratic to begin with. And I think that's a prognostication that can be defended if I had time to go in some of the history of Europe. But on the whole, as we've seen, he's positive about what he sees. And he's writing, remember, for an audience that he thinks doesn't like America, doesn't like democracy, and is prepared to see it as a threat. Tocqueville sees Americans overcoming the dangers of individualism by their involvement in local self-government and by their proclivity to create and work in voluntary associations, or the little platoons in Edmund Burke's phrase. He sees religion and the non-privileged place of different churches and sects in America as tending to produce virtuous behavior and to place limits on destructive impulses. He sees an America bursting with prosperity, resourceful in commerce, creative in imagination. But he also sees a threat. The things which have produced America's success could in time produce a future much gloomier and could keep democratic America from living up to its potential. And I think I want to quote at some length some of the things he was saying and intersperse it with my own comments, because I can't really improve on Tocqueville's prose. I do not fear that in their chiefs Americans will find tyrants, he says, but rather schoolmasters in this phrase. Not a hard despotism, but a soft despotism. I think that, therefore, the kind of oppression with which democratic peoples are threatened will resemble nothing that has preceded it in the world. Our contemporaries would not find its image in their memories. I myself seek in vain an expression that exactly reproduces the idea that I form for myself and that contains it. The old words despotism and tyranny are not suitable. The thing is new, therefore I must try to define it, since I cannot name it. I want to imagine with what new features despotism could be produced in the world. I see an innumerable crowd of like and equal men who resolve without repose, procuring the small and vulgar pleasures with which they fill their souls. Each of them, withdrawn and apart, is like a stranger to the destiny of all the others. His children and his particular friends form the whole human species for him. This is the individualism again. As for dwelling with his fellow citizen, he is beside them, but he does not see them. He touches them and does not feel them. He exists only in himself and for himself alone, and if a family remains for him, one can at least say he no longer has a native country. And it's a view, in other words, in which the forces that he sees holding people together and avoiding the threat of isolation and individualism is a threat to America. And he's writing about an America, he's presaging here, I think, an America that is much larger than he's describing here. When Tocqueville came here, Paris had 800,000 people. America's largest city, New York, had 200,000. Charleston, 30,000. The second largest city in the South after New Orleans. Over the next century, industrialization and vast immigration changed that demography hugely. By 1912, 100 years ago, New York had 5 million people, Chicago 2 million, Philadelphia 1.5 million, although Charleston was still down there with only 58,000. And you'd had these vast waves of immigration, starting from Ireland and Germany in the 1840s, which were different cultures. Many of these immigrants were Catholics in a mostly Protestant country that was suspicious of Catholics. You had immigration from the 1890s. You start having a lot of immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, which is very alarming to many Americans. We have as many as year 1907, 1,200,000 immigrants arrive in a country of 86 million. That's as much immigration as we've had in the last decade annually in a country of more than three times that size. So you're talking about a huge inundation of people who come with strange languages, strange mores. They work in garment sweatshops and steel and assembly lines. These are people who end up owning no property. They rent their homes, often don't even have bank accounts. The The workmen are paid with cash in a pay envelope or with a check that they cash at the bar outside the factory, and the wives line up outside the factory gate to get the check before they go into the bar and stand drinks for everybody. But it's the property holder's democracy that we seem to be in 1830 suddenly is not a property holder's democracy anymore. We've suffered what Robert Nisbet calls a loss of community. As Robert Putnam, the sociologist, recently found to his dismay, he didn't want to report it, the parts of America today with the greatest ethnic and racial diversity are also the part with the highest degree of lack of trust in others and participation of voluntary associations. Tocqueville was looking forward, I think, here to a threat that in a differently kind of America, you would have a superintending government creating soft despotism that would break the ties between individuals and put them in a situation of isolation, of individualism. And he describes this process in these words. Above these, an immense tutelary power is elevated, which alone takes charge of assuring their enjoyments and watching over their fate. It is absolute, detailed, regular, far-seeing, and mild. It would resemble paternal power if, like that, it had for its object to prepare men for manhood. But on the contrary, it seeks only to keep them fixed irrevocably in childhood. It likes citizens to enjoy themselves. It willingly works for their happiness, but it wants to be the unique agent and sole arbiter of that. It provides for their security, foresees and secures their needs, facilitates their pleasures, conducts their principal affairs, directs their industry, regulates their estate, divides their inheritance. Can it not take away from them entirely the trouble of thinking and the pain of living? So it is that every day it renders the employment of free will less useful and more rare. It confines the action of the will in a smaller space and little by little steals the very use of it from the citizen. Equality has prepared men for all these things. It has disposed them to tolerate them and even to regard them as a benefit. And I think here Tocqueville is providing 80 years before the progressive movement, 100 years before the New Deal, the conservative critique and credential of these programs. It is not simply that they are economically harmful, that they tend to deter economic activity, prosperity and economic growth. It is their effect on the character of people, the effect that a superintending government that tends to try to protect you from all damage and provide perfect security, one that's run by a centralized bureaucratic apparatus, run by alleged experts, justified by the supposed inability of ordinary people to take care of themselves and navigate the shoals and reefs of an advanced industrial democracy. This soft despotism tends to destroy human character. This despotism that assumes that people are incompetent children, in treating them like that, tends to make them that behave like that and be like that. Tocqueville, in an earlier passage, described the possibility that something far worse can come into existence, a very hard despotism or tyranny that would try to take over the operation of every institution of society and to abolish freedoms of speech and religion. In other words, he foresees 20th century totalitarianism. And he clearly states that soft despotism is better than that. But he goes on to insist to describe how it will have a bad effect on people's character and that it will tend to eradicate the aspects of American character that he saw as producing virtue in the democratic America of the 1830s. He writes, "Thus, after taking each individual by turn in its powerful hands and kneading him as it likes, the sovereign extends its arms over society as a whole. It covers its surface with a network of small, complicated, painstaking, uniform rules, bureaucracy, through which the most original minds and the most vigorous souls cannot clear a way to surpass the crowd. It does not break wills, but it softens them, bends them and directs them. It rarely forces one to act, but it constantly opposes itself to one as acting. It does not destroy, it prevents things from being born. It does not tyrannize, it hinders, compromises, enervates, extinguishes, dazes, and finally reduces each nation to being nothing more than a herd of timid and industrious animals of which the government is a shepherd." I've always believed that this sort of regulated, mild, and peaceful servitude, whose picture I've just painted could be combined better than one imagines with some external forms of freedom, and that it would not be impossible for it to be established in the very shadow of the sovereignty of the people. And stop to consider a moment what he's talking, that he's describing a democratic people as a herd of timid and industrial animals. What this reminds me of is the ideas of progressive education, which have dominated the education schools and much of our public school system since the 1920s, the tutelary power of the teachers' colleges and lately these teacher unions. These are people who have taken the place of the local authorities who superintended the public schools for which most of the century after Tocqueville wrote, intended to require a more rigorous course of study and one that emphasized the special character of American life as described by Tocqueville. But the aim of progressive education is not to produce excellence, not to enable people to rise in life. They don't really like that very much. They want to teach basic arithmetic. They want to teach people enough and give them enough sense of absorbing the discipline of the ringing bells and the time clock so that they can work in Henry Ford's Model T factory and then vote for the kind of people that these people would like them to vote for. They could make enough money for food, clothing, and shelter, enough time for leisure, for radio or movies or TVs, facilitating their pleasures, as Tocqueville put it, and to endorse in their occasional vote, or as Tocqueville puts it, citizens leave their dependence for a moment to indicate their master and then re-enter it. That's how he sees the democratic process, the political process working in a system of soft despotism. In this view, he portrays a situation where we have gone far along the road to soft despotism and there is no turning around. I want to suggest something a little different, something that's, from my point of view, a little more optimistic. First of all, many of the features of America that Tocqueville describes are still part of American life. America still abounds in voluntary associations more than any other nation in the world. There are some indications the percentage of people involved in such associations are declining, as Robert Putnam suggested in his book, Bowling Alone, but I think there's some important countervailing evidence that's come forward. So voluntary associations are part of American life. Americans give more money and volunteer more time for charity than people in any other significant nation in the world, and by a lot. Arthur Brooks, the president of American Enterprise Institute, has documented this. It's part of an American tradition. The tradition of American philanthropy is still strong. Remember that a century ago in that progressive era, masters of great fortune like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller gave enormous sums to charity and changed America life through building our system of libraries. Rockefeller created our medical research institutions and the rigorous medical schools that we have today and the teaching hospitals. That was the creation of John D. Rockefeller, a contribution to American life that was above that of many government policies and government programs. So the federal government does not have, the tutelary power does not have a monopoly in many areas. And we've still got philanthropy. And Bill Gates is trying to be a smart philanthropist, and he's done some dumb things, and he's taken metrics, and he's trying to do better. We do have a vital philanthropic thing. And in two important respects, I think we still remain an exceptional nation in the way that Tocqueville was the first to recognize. One is that we're still, by and large, a religious people and a people who are respectful of the religion of others. There's a large increasing percentage of people that identify themselves as unbelievers. It is still very low. The sociologists and sophisticateds that predicted that Europe has gone secular and the United States, when it advances enough, will go secular too, have simply been proven wrong by events. If anything, forms of sort of strengthened religion that demand greater devotion from their followers have gained strength at the risk at the expense of religions whose doctrines have become undifferentiable from the George McGovern platform in the 1972 presidential election. Second way that we've remained an exceptional nation, as we were at Tocqueville's time, arguably we're not a century ago in the progressive era, but I would submit are again, is that we're a property owner's democracy. Most Americans in the course of their working lives accumulate significant amounts, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of property in the form of real estate and financial estimates. We're in an economic downturn period now, by no means the most severe in our history, but the fact that most Americans, I believe, continue to look forward to and with good reason to accumulated property means that they're less likely to sign up to be a member of a herd of timid industrial animals. Finally, I believe a case can be made that American voters have not supinely ratified the creation of soft despotism. They've tended to resist it. When parties in power have tried to expand the size and scope of government, they've been sharply rebuked by the voters. Woodrow Wilson's New Freedom, an attempted abolition of Congress's prerogative of declaring war, was rebuked by the record majority cast for Warren G. Harding's return to normalcy in 1920. Franklin Roosevelt's plan to pack the Supreme Court and New Deal's governors, refusal to enforce the law against illegal sit-down strikes, was rebuked in the elections of 1938 and subsequent years, which produced anti-New Deal Congresses for 20 years. Lyndon Johnson's Great Society was soundly rebuked in the elections of 1966 and 68, and the stagflation that prevailed during Jimmy Carter's presidency produced a 44-state landslide for Ronald Reagan in 1980. The two most recent Democratic presidents, after raising taxes and advancing a national health care plan, were both rebuked sharply by record Republican victories in the off-year elections of 1994 and 2010. Now, many conservative thinkers, the pessimists, would reply that these victories did not change the trajectory of public policy, that creeping socialism just kept creeping. There's something to this, but I think the argument's overstated. Tax rates were vastly cut, and wartime nationalization of railroads and shipyards was ended after 1920. And by the way, the latter policy was not repeated in the next World War. The Republican Congress elected in 1946 rejected New Deal policies for national health insurance, federal aid to education, government dominance of the housing industry. It ended wartime wage and price controls and significantly restricted the power of labor unions. These public policies were enduring, some for a generation, some to this day, and they led to post-war prosperity when almost everybody expected a return to depression. The elections rejecting the Great Society led over the next 20 years, administrations of both parties, to deregulation of transportation and communications, which squeezed huge costs out of service. It's kind of like the transportation communication revolutions that happened on either side of Tocqueville's visit that enabled Americans to live much better and to be much more productive. And in the 1990s, we saw a vast decrease in welfare dependency and crime, resulting almost entirely from the pioneering efforts of reformers at state and local governments, subsidiarity. Governor Tommy Thompson of Wisconsin, New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani leading the way, and imitated and adapted by the leaders of many other states and cities, most of them Republicans, but many of them Democrats as well, and in which the federal government was basically an interested and occasionally helpful bystander. The 2010 elections have not yet been followed by major public policy reversals, but could be depending on the outcome of the elections this year. And we do know that the president's health care law, which he expected to be popular, has instead become so unpopular that he barely mentioned it in his State of the Union address last month. Silence tells you a lot in that situation. Let me let Tocqueville have the last word. The aristocrat who was so alert to the strengths of democracy, even while keenly identifying its weaknesses, was a man of piercing intelligence. And to read him, you really have to read him slowly and take in a little bit. Someone of my acquaintance has Tocqueville on her Kindle to read a chapter or so every so often, and to ponder, because each often single paragraphs have insights that could produce a whole academic career for most people. But this extraordinary man, though he's one of the great thinkers of our age, of any age, a person whose piercing intelligence is so much greater than that of almost anybody who has ever tried to do what he tried to do, at the same time also has a faith in the capacity of ordinary people to, in the right circumstances, govern themselves and contribute to the building of a decent and virtuous society. Those who advocated the course of what he calls soft despotism lack this faith. They see ordinary people as incapable of self-governance, in need of a shepherd to guide the herd the right direction. Tocqueville sees us ordinary mortals, so far below him, as something better. Nobody says it better than himself. Let me conclude with the final passage of the second volume of Democracy in America. As for myself, having come to the final stage of my course, to discover from afar, but at once, all the diverse objects that I had contemplated separately in advancing. I feel full of fears and full of hopes. I see great perils that it is possible to ward off, great evils that one can avoid or restrain, and I become more and more firm in the belief that to be honest and prosperous, it is still enough for democratic nations to wish it. I am not unaware that several of my contemporaries have thought that peoples are never masters of themselves here below and that they necessarily obey, I do not know which insurmountable and unintelligent force born of previous events, the race, the soil, or the climate. Those are false and cowardly doctrines that can never produce any but weak men and pusillanimous nations. Providence has not created the human race either entirely independent or perfectly slave. It traces, it is true, a fatal circle around each man that he cannot leave. But within its vast limits, man is powerful and free. So are societies. Nations of our day cannot have it that conditions within them are not equal, but it depends on them whether equality leads to servitude or to freedom, to enlightenment or barbarism, to prosperity or misery. Thank you.
That was an absolutely brilliant lecture. Thank you so much. That was brilliant. I was riveted. I can hardly wait to see it on tape again. I mean, there's so much in there. Thank you so much. We're going to take a brief break, and then we'll come back and do Q&A. I am thrilled to have heard one of the great lectures ever by Michael Barone. I mean, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And now it's time to dissect that lecture and hopefully catch him on something, which I doubt we could ever do. But let's take some questions. Gentlemen? Mr. Lacey?
I have a question on the soft despotism topic.
Yeah.
He mentions that part of the danger is the government creating the net of the minute regulations and laws, et cetera, et cetera. Yet when we look to solve problems in this country, and we tend to do so through the proper democratic channels, all Congress can really do is legislate more. So we end up creating more laws. So do you ever see a way to avoid that problem, or is it just kind of a self-perpetuating thing?
One of your colleagues told me that he was taking accounting, was guiding me around this morning, and he was taking a look at the U.S. tax code. Advocates of the kind of policies that conservatives would call soft despotism will say to you, look, it's a complicated society. If we're going to tax income, you got to define income. And in a complicated society, there can be lots of ways of doing that, and people will tend to want to minimize their revenue thing, as they have a right to do under several principles of law if they do it legally. So you have to write it. I mean, when I took Tax 1 in law school, the first question that the professor asked, he was a New Deal liberal, actually, good teacher, he said, Mr. Barone, what is income? And what's your answer to that? Well, your answer is the tax code and so forth. It's an argument for the principle of subsidiarity in part, isn't it? It's an argument for free market capitalism as opposed to having a government health care bill that establishes, all these different things. And requires, as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010 provides, the secretary shall appear something like 155 times in the 1,200 pages or whatever it is of that legislation, and typically it's issue regulations. And we've just seen a kind of political firestorm over one regulation, which many people believe infringes on the free exercise of religion clause of the Constitution. You can't avoid some of those decisions when you have a centralized decision maker. You're either going to require people to pay for those abortions or you're not, and people are going to be unhappy whichever decision you make. It's an argument for subsidiarity, it's an argument for markets, it's an argument for letting people choose the things they want. Now, the progressive New Deal tradition says, look, the ordinary person just can't understand that. They can't navigate their way through that. And they will point you to individuals who have made dumb choices and done things that seem to be pretty clearly to their detriment.
And I guess what Tocqueville is suggesting, or those who see his description of soft despotism as something you want to avoid, are suggesting that, yes, you will have those costs, and no, you cannot have 100% of everything go right, but that an attempt to be fail-safe is sure to fail. It will never work, in part because centralized decision makers will get something wrong. We have a beautiful metro system in Washington, which is suffering now from deferred maintenance and some other problems that you can ascribe to certain political actors. But it doesn't go to a place called Tyson's Corner. All of the lines are directed to go to sort of downtown office destinations. It was designed in the late 60s, early 70s. It does not go to Tyson's Corner, which is the largest collection of office buildings within about a square mile. Mr. McGurk seems to be from Northern Virginia or something. Yeah, well, which is the biggest office square footage between Washington and Atlanta. So it's like significant. And my friend Joel Garrow, the author of Edge City, former reporter of the Washington Post, went to the designers of the metro system and said, why didn't you build a station or two at Tyson's Corner? And they said, well, we didn't think there'd be any development there. We thought everybody would go downtown. Isn't that the way cities have always been? Well, actually, Joel, who knows something about the history of cities, and my friend Joel Kotkin, knows that's not the way cities have always been. It's an artifact of the railroad infrastructure, technology of a rather small point in time, 1880, 1920. They just missed it. Now they're trying to build station there at huge expense, and will we spend an extra $200 million to put it above ground or underground or something like that? Just unfathomable things, because central planners get things wrong. I mean, the Soviet system, it never works very well. And this is, I guess, perhaps this comes out later with Friedrich Hayek and The Road to Serfdom, which in some ways Tocqueville is anticipating, that distills the wisdom of crowds into a set of decisions which on average perform much better than any central planner can perform, because a central planner can never know as many things as all the participants in a free market know. And, the central planners who decided Metro didn't get it. There's a guy named John T. Till Hazel in Northern Virginia who is a lawyer. Who did land acquisition for the Commonwealth of Virginia Highway Department on the Washington Beltway. He saw this intersection at Chain Bridge Road, Leesburg Pike, and the Beltway as an important thing, and he bought up all kinds of land there and got leases and options on the other. The place is called Tyson's Corner. Till Hazel is a very rich man. He saw the market, and Hazel saw something that the planners didn't see.
I'm going to jump in here for a second and talk about Tocqueville's notion of self-interest rightly understood. What does Tocqueville think that local institutions, why does he think that they're so essential to preserving liberty? I think that's one of the key questions that we should get out of this. And what's the relationship between individualism and equality, as he discusses it? I'm going to read a short passage from de Tocqueville, basically he comes here to glean the secret of the success in sustaining a decentralized government and a society in which liberty thrives, and he's doing this in contrast to France, where the revolution has failed over and over again. And I quote, "I see an innumerable multitude of men, alike and equal, constantly circling around in the pursuit of petty and banal pleasures with which they glut their souls. Each of them, withdrawn into himself, is almost unaware of the fate of the rest. Mankind, for him, consists in his children and his personal friends. As for the rest of his fellow citizens, they are near enough, but he does not notice them. He touches them, but feels nothing. He exists in and for himself, and though he may still may have a family, one can at least say that he has not got a fatherland." Any comments on that, gentlemen? Cadet Salmaska?
Well, I think, self-interest rightly understood, I think, is just the belief that you know, it ties in with individualism in that we should all have the capacity and the opportunity to pursue in our own individual minds what we feel is right, what we feel is necessary, you know, what we may particularly be drawn to. And I think Tocqueville, when he's writing on that, really gets to, you know, that's how communities are fostered, through individual wants and needs and people coming together. It's not, and I think it's a stark contrast from central planning.
I'm going to also try to relate this back for a few seconds to Aristotle. Man flourishes in social relationships. We're going back to Aristotle. That's the very first lecture. Local relationships obviate the need for a centralized state to involve itself in most social concerns. And I think Tocqueville is in many ways saying something very similar to what Aristotle says. Comments? Yes, Mr. Ford.
Sir, I thought about that when I was reading the Nesbitt article. But the thing that jumped out at me was that Aristotle also said that you really can't control a society over 5,400 people. But this jumped out at me at the Nesbitt article because he talks about the individualism in an urban setting. And I think it takes away, those urban settings take away the identity that people have, the identity politics, so to speak, where we have so many different people from so many different places that aren't really communal. And as we've kind of evolved, we don't necessarily have those community religion like you were speaking of earlier on, sir, that brings people together, and which ties into the self-interest, where I grew up in a small town, actually 4,500 people, so I fit Aristotle's mold. But, you know, if a tornado comes through the country, people are out there from the churches helping build up the community and everything, which would be self-interest rightly understood, if I'm interpreting this correctly.
Well, one of the reasons I mentioned, the big cities of 1910, and sort of cribbed from a lecture I did on another subject, but it struck me, the elites of 100 years ago, whether they were progressives or the critics of the progressives, one thing they were afraid about was revolution. What would these people do? You'd had the Paris Commune in 1870-71, you'd had the revolutions of 1848, you would have the revolution of Russia in 1917-18, you had revolutions in Budapest and Munich and Berlin after World War I. What would happen if this mass of people decided to kill you and destroy all your stuff? I was actually prompted to think of this years ago when I was visiting Newport, Rhode Island, and going through a tour of one of the, quote, cottages, which are sort of very fancy mansions that these people in New York would build, and they'd take their steamship up from New York to the Newport for the spewing all sorts of coal dust on everybody else, up to Newport for the weekend. And one of the rooms, they all said, well, this settee was owned by Marie Antoinette, and this belonged to Marie Antoinette, and this belonged to King Louis XVI. And I said, gee, these people kind of had a fixation on the king and queen who were guillotined. And where does that come from? Then I thought, you know, they weren't too sure that they weren't going to be guillotined or killed by the mob themselves. They didn't know what we know, that kind of revolution didn't happen here. And we have all sorts of good reasons why it didn't. But, you know, your picture of people alienated, I start off with demography often, and, you know, in 1910, as I said, New York City, the five boroughs had 5 million people. Manhattan had 2.3 million people. The current population of Manhattan, by the way, is 1.6 million. So they had 2.3 million. One half of them, 1.15 million, lived in south of 14th Street in Manhattan, and that is essentially the size of the peninsula of Charleston. Imagine 1 million people living from here south to the Battery, 1,200,000 people living. You were looking at the most crowded spot on Earth, people speaking all these different languages, and so I think your picture of that is the right one. And Tocqueville's warning that in that kind of a situation, which of course was like Paris, in that he knew that it had a revolution in 1789 and 97, that had a whiff of grapeshot in 1795, that had a revolution in 1830, that this kind of thing could occur. And we didn't, for a variety of reasons, including that, the efforts of some often religiously based charities get involved in those areas down, those cities, and that prosperity enables people to fan out and live lives that are economically independent, and that we build things through the church. So you have Catholic and Jewish organizations, for example, playing significant roles in those situations.
Let's take some more questions from y'all. Yes, sir. Mr. Monty.
Sir, Turbo points out that individualism can contribute to despotism. Also says traditional associations are excellent tools to combat individualism, such as relying on close connections to family, community, and churches. Do you think there might be a potential growth of despotism in the 21st century as social networking media rapidly grows and people begin to connect heavier on these social technologies and isolate themselves from these traditional associations in the community?
Well, I'd like to ask you that question. You're probably better positioned to answer it than I am. What Mr. Salmaska was saying kind of is that, pointing out that having these connections and associations with people tends to make people want to behave in a virtuous way, and that's sort of what Tocqueville's teaching us. And I guess your question is, is Facebook going to want to be, does that make us behave in a personal way? How many here do Facebook? I don't do it. I have a Facebook page that they put together at the Examiner or something.
I don't do it either. I can't figure out.
I'm saying, what am I going to write? I'm at Whole Foods today. It doesn't look like they've got good tomatoes this week. Are the kind of communities that are created on this that are fascinating. And I have a very good friend who's a Brazilian diplomat who keeps in touch with people all over the world on this. And for the Brazilians, Orkut has been replaced, which was their big social network, by Facebook. And, keeps in touch with it and puts a lot of things on it. Is that going to make us more virtuous people? What do you think? Or do we have the capacity to conceal and prevaricate on social network, or to, conceal some aspects of our character? Of course, we always try to do that to some extent in a society even thick with voluntary association. We don't want our neighbors to know our bad habits. But what's your thought?
I wasn't really sure. That's why I was asking you. just how this networking is just changing the whole dynamics of community and
it stretches it in space and time, doesn't it? So my Brazilian friend can keep up with his friends in Beijing, Paris, Brasilia, Washington, and stuff fairly easily. That's, between Skype and Facebook, you're in constant touch with people, and it's a force that strengthens community, as some things like long-distance telephone strengthens the community. You can call... I can remember when direct distance dialing first came in the mid-1950s. Before that, to make a long distance call, we didn't have cell phones. We had black phones. That's the only color ATT wanted you to have. And you'd call O for operator and wait for the dial to come around, as it did. It took a long time with the O. And they'd say, I want to call, New York, Gramercy 46029. And then you'd hang up and wait for them to call back and tell you that the call had been put through. It cost $1 a minute when the average salary or wage in America was $100 a week. And people did not communicate by long-distance phone. It's different today. I used to call, when I was in college in the 1960s, I talked to my parents once every 2 weeks or so. And they didn't call me. And they were poor. My father was a doctor. They had money. We didn't use long-distance phone to call. And... this was $1 a minute. Most conversations began on long distance by saying, who died? And so now you have, my feeling is that it can make community work better in some ways by stretching it over time and place. And by collapsing time, the way collapsing place, like the long distance telephone did, like the telegraph did, like canals did. But you have to make some effort in some way. And, you may, not know who lives in the apartment building next door. It's like New York apartments are supposedly. You know, say somebody says, well, who's that person passing you the apartment? You say, oh, I don't know. They've only lived here for 18 years.
Next question. Yes, Mr. Faust.
I just want to address the, you really seem to have a very optimistic view of the direction that America's heading, or at least the way things are going right now. And we talked about religion and light self-interest, which of course served two purposes, which helped to help the community. One is to restrain man's wants, thus he's not as dependent on the government, doesn't need as much. And two, for them to help each other through giving things. But one thing that really wasn't as well addressed, I felt like that was in our readings, was the centralization of power in the government as equality comes. As people get more equality, then they want more equality, and the little inequalities just seem so much bigger. And so we invest more and more power into the government. And like the Tocqueville in his writings, he made observations then, just trying to make an observation of what's going on today. We tend to be seeing that with Obamacare, I mean, an expansion of government to try to create equalities that weren't necessarily guaranteed or there before. And Occupy Wall Street is another good one, where the 99%ers are out protesting against the 1%, and we're just seeing a growing of this today. We're also seeing it in our businesses, where we are driving business away through overregulation, which is making businesses go overseas. And I mean, this is something that de Tocqueville observed and said would be the downfall of America. It's not going to be the individual, it's going to be the cry of equality will be at America's death throes.
The cry of equality and the argument that centralization is the only fair way to handle equality in a situation, that the only fair way to structure affairs. And the progressives went farther and said it's efficient. And that argument in many ways has been disproven. There are some things you do want to do centrally, but it is efficient. I think one of the things that added to the prestige of the centralization movement is the whole civil rights issue. Because if you go back to the 1950s, among the defenders of decentralization, the critiques of the New Deal, you had people like William F. Buckley and National Review were defending Southern legally imposed racial segregation as, you know, local control. These people know best what they want. The sort of good-hearted defense of it that I think existed was, if we don't have these rules in place, a lot of people are going to kill a lot of people. Mostly it's going to be white people killing black people, and that's not good. There's too much bloodthirstiness in this society. And we also have some black people killing white people, and it's not good either. I think that was the good-hearted argument that people didn't express publicly, but the people that maintained this system would have told you if they were being exactly frank. You don't know how much those white people are just going around killing these other people. And, you know, we've had lynchings in the past. We don't want to see that in the future. If you want an orderly society, we'll try to get black people treated a little more fairly and maybe even open a college for them and stuff, but we're not going to, don't try and mix it or you'll have violence. That would have been the argument. And, you know, Americans rejected that, basically. In a national movement. So anytime you advocate decentralization, the comeback is always, well, you wouldn't have been for Brown versus Board of Education. You wouldn't have been for desegregation in the South. My response is that's, you know, an exception that proves the rule. It was an issue that was so great, but it was there. But I think that still has some force in one way, and I'll give you an example of an issue proposal that was brought forward by last week's lecturer, Newt Gingrich, in his presidential campaign. He made the proposal that we should deal with immigration by providing for legalization of certain very long-standing illegal immigrants who met certain criteria, and he was somewhat vague about it, but you got the impression, you know, family ties, working, and so forth, by local boards that would be analogous to the local draft boards that decided who would be drafted in World War II, and a system that continued in place until the draft was abolished in 1971. And I thought that was mistaken for, that was not, I wrote that that was not a viable policy because on some issues, local decision making was acceptable to Americans of the 1940s, but by the mid 60s, the local decisions by draft boards came to seem arbitrary, unfair, because they weren't nationally uniform. And as I've thought about it, the civil rights issue is the reason for both sets of feelings. In the 1940s America, as I said, you had a South that was very different from the North and very separated from. Northerners did not come for vacation in Charleston, South Carolina. The Mallory factors would not have moved from New York to Charleston. In fact, the one movement, there was a movement in the other direction. There was a U.S. district judge here, J. Waddy's Waring, appointed, I think, by Roosevelt, who was a member of the Charleston elite, and gave a couple of decisions in the early civil rights era. And he was so ostracized by local society and perhaps threatened, he resigned his federal judgeship and moved to New York. He couldn't live in Charleston anymore. Now, that America's vanished. But that was the America of 1940. And in that America, you had a quarter of the people living on farms. Are you going to send this farm boy away when his mom is disabled and his father has died and nobody else can till the field? Let the locals make the decision. They'll know about it. And you have other people living in the big cities where the, you know, the draft board's going to be run by the local Tammany Hall machine. Okay, they know the local community. Let them handle it. It seemed fair in a way where you're deciding life and death decisions that you do that. By 1965, when I was in college and about to go to law school, it seemed very unfair because we'd gone through that civil rights revolution and the message had been you have to have one standard for the whole country. It is unfair not to have a uniform standard and to be able to decide which draft board you're going to go enlist in to try and avoid military service is really wrong too, like, you know, adept people like me and people I know did. So that's kind of wrong. And so we rejected that, and so I thought Newt was out of step, but maybe he's back in step. And there's also a loophole on immigration that, you know, you go to East Los Angeles, which is 95% Latino and entry level and, you know, 30% illegal, they're going to legalize everybody. But you had another point.
Tocqueville talks about the dangers of blanket rules and how that comes about whenever it's over-centralized. Instead of having rules that fit the communities and fit the needs of the people, you're making blanket rules which become the red tape that people are stumbling on because what's good for one area isn't necessarily good for everybody else.
I think that's undoubtedly true. It's a very strong argument. It's also a stronger argument for market provision rather than government deciding everything. It's the argument that the Republicans who backed Medicare Part D, the prescription drug benefit passed in 2003, make, is that you have the insurance companies come in with competing plans, constructed with certain limiting principles, but with competing plans which they formulate. Rather than having the government say, okay, each plan has to do this, or we're going to have one plan like Medicare which does this, and so forth. And so I think the argument that you're citing, the sort of decentralized slash market argument, has gained strength in the last 40 years, and it's gained strength off a lot of things. The deregulation movement. We used to have trucking regulation passed in the New Deal, supposedly to keep prices up, to protect truckers from losing their jobs, that said if you were hauling horse feathers from Pittsburgh to Cleveland, you have to get a certificate of convenience and necessity from the Interstate Commerce Commission saying that it's necessary for you to haul horse feathers. And, of course, there'll be a proceeding in which that will be opposed by the single company that is now licensed to haul horse feathers from Pittsburgh to Cleveland. And they pay, you know, they get paid $7 a pound to do it under a rate the ICC has. Well, Ralph Nader wrote a piece against that, wrote a whole book about how that's ridiculous and ripping off consumers. Mm-hmm. Let people who meet basic safety conditions ship whatever they want, wherever they want, and let people decide what they want to pay for it. And we abolished the ICC. So in some areas, America has very much accepted your argument. I think on life and death decisions like the draft, it's a harder sell. And a decision like immigration legalization is somewhere in between.
I'm going to go to another reading, and we can come back to this. One of the readings we had was Oresti Bronson. And he talks about the idea of what true progress is and the only legitimate justification for war against Southern independence. And I think that he also suggests that the founders built something better than they knew, and that's a direct quote, built something better than they even knew. For Bronson, I think the war is only justified insofar as it seeks to sustain ideology of the nation. And if the ethno-ideology is not being sustained, then he thinks war is justifiable. And I think that's something I wanted you to take away from this. He also believes that constitutional government is essential to preserving a society. But he believes that Bronson wants to maintain continuity with the organizing principles of the revolution. And that's, in some ways, how he actually justifies the Southern move from independence. He goes on to say that the founders drew upon ancient and medieval principles that are inherited through the Enlightenment philosophers, but that those principles, and here's the key, are stronger than the philosophers or even the founders recognized. The Anglo-American legal and political traditions communicate those political and social principles that are more compelling than even the founders recognized. He goes on, he insists that the war against Southern independence was just as much a war against Northern democracy as it is against Southern aristocracy. So I wanted you to just take that away from the reading and see how it fits into what de Tocqueville sees, and I think it does fit in quite well. Let's take a question on anything at this point, but I wanted to give you that as some context. Mr. Salmask, I saw you had your hand up again.
Well, I just, Mr. Barone mentioned Medicare, and it reminded me of earlier this week, the New York Times had an expose on Ron Paul and his early career. When he first opened up his medical practice there, he refused to participate in Medicare or Medicaid. And a lot of people, of course, say, oh, well, you don't want to treat poor people. Well, no, he treated anyone, but those people who could not pay, he accepted, you know, vegetables, dozen eggs. And I think that speaks a lot towards, you know, our ability as individuals to make our own contracts and you know, the ability of us to take care of each other. We don't need these centralized programs like Medicare and Medicaid. And I think when we have an abundance of them, you know, you spoke of America's prevalence of charity and giving to things like that. And I think we hold an extreme capacity to take care of each other on an individual, you know, smaller community basis rather than, you know, big centralized government programs. And I think that's
just like my arguments my father was making around the family dinner table in the late 50s and early 60s.
Well, no doubt the thing.
Good arguments, though.
My father was a physician and a surgeon. His father had been a doctor. He was from a family of Sicilian immigrants. And unusually, they sent him to college and medical school. It was sort of more like Jewish immigrants than Italian immigrants. And he became a doctor and moved to Detroit, which was then the great growing dynamic city in the country. Fastest growing major metro area in the United States, 1900 to 1930, except for Los Angeles. It was number two to LA. And it was bigger then. And, well, yeah, they didn't charge. You know, he developed a fine sense of which patients were freeloading and said they couldn't afford it but actually could, and which ones tried to pay you but you knew they really couldn't afford it and you just tried to settle it. I mean, I saw people in his office on his office hours on Tuesday and Thursday nights. You know, they'd pay for the office call and the woman would get out her wallet out of her purse and take out $4 bills and then get out the change purse and put the last dollar on there out of change. It was $5 for an office call, $300 for an appendectomy in the 1950s. You know, that was a free market system. People provided for that. You just ate the cost of that. Sometimes people came out badly. I mean, my grandfather, Barone, lost a house that he couldn't keep up the mortgage payment on in the 1930s. Couldn't keep up a mortgage payment of $100 a month, a doctor. Well, there was mass unemployment. People couldn't pay him. They'd bring in cookies or chicken or something. Yeah, I mean, that was how you got paid. You know, some olive oil or something. I don't know what they made. You know, the tomato sauce. They'd bring in, you do what you can, because a lot of his patients were Italian. And, but, you know, in some ways, the medical profession, that's not today's medical profession. You can't just wish that situation into existence. And you can also imagine that, you know, there were situations that where a lot of people weren't getting care that you probably think should have, that if you were all-knowing, you would want to have get care. You know, not all doctors were going to do this and so forth and so on. So
you know, increasingly people who enter the medical profession, MDs, are not do not go into become little entrepreneurs with their own little offices. They're becoming part of larger organizations, signing up on hospital staffs, doing this and that. It may be that this is also the results of, in part, of about half the graduates now are being are women. Who are, you know, somewhat less, tend to be, you know, I could be attacked for saying things like this, but I think it's just empirically true, who are more likely to want to have stated, you know, definite hours rather than office hours on Tuesday and Thursday nights. Oh, and also be on call 24 hours a day for your patients who are really sick and in the hospital, and you've got ER duty. You know, my dad left three consecutive Christmas Day parties to go to the emergency room and sew people up. So, not everybody wants that kind of life, and people have good reason for not wanting to do so. It, you know, that's time away from your family. So, you know, we're not going to retrieve that perhaps golden era of medicine ever again. We do have, you know, we're facing in this election some what may be very serious questions and consequences may flow depending on how the voters vote, whether or not this law is passed in 2010 is going to go into effect or how it will go into effect. And we also face the interesting question, I was talking about in a class this morning, of the constitutionality of this law. It's been more than 70 years.
Commerce Clause covers everything.
Well, that's what I was taught in law school. In law school, we were taught Wickard v. Filburn, he can't produce you know, oats for his own cows. With it, unless the government says he can. That was a 1941 decision, and you know, so Wickard v. Filburn is maybe dead. I mean, it, we have for the first time in 70 years a Supreme Court giving consideration and indeed devoting a highly unusual 5.5 hours of oral argument to the constitutionality of a major piece of economic legislation, and I think one result is bound to be that whichever way or however the court rules, the question of constitutionality of many pieces of legislation will become a lively political and perhaps legal issue, which has not been the case for the last 70 years. That's a difference. It's a difference that gets us more towards, that sends us at least a little bit in a decentralizing situation as far as these government apparatuses go, because to the extent that's an issue, it may inhibit people from even proposing some forms of centralization, which they might otherwise, in the, you know, Wickard v. Filburn atmosphere, might have done.
You had a follow-up, Mr. Somasco?
Well, just to tag on to that, why is everything becoming a grandiose constitutional question now? I mean...
Well, it's grandiose because it's a... it's a constitution we are expounding, as Chief Justice John Marshall wrote, because you've, you know, it's an interesting question. Because you have this, in this case, the novelty, you got two interesting constitutional questions here at least, the novelty of a mandate to buy a commercial product. We've never had, a court rule that Congress can require that. They've never done it before. I mean, everybody has searched the precedents as far as the people that want this to be upheld. Surely it would have come forward with a precedent if they could have found anything that they could have somehow ingeniously cited as precedent. They haven't done so. So we can be sure they've tried, and it's not there. So it's a novel question. And, we have a constitution of limited powers. Tocqueville spent some chapters on the Constitution, which I confess I did not review for this meeting. But the idea of limited government and subsidiarity is written into the Constitution to at least some extent. Now, a couple of the issues we were discussing in relation to centralization are issues that do look like they're national in scope. Who serves in the military in time of war, a war time in which, by the way, 400,000 people in the military died, okay? You've got names on your plaques here at the Citadel, and it's a pretty big one for World War II. If you were here during World War II, you knew lots of those people who died. And the question of immigration, who gets within our boundaries. I mean, there's no rule of international law or national law. We have no obligation whatever to admit anybody of any character to the United States except perhaps diplomats under rules of international law. And even then, we don't have to recognize a country and we can declare them persona non grata. Nobody has a right to come into the United States who's not a citizen here. We prudently and intelligently let lots of people come in as visitors, as people doing business, as immigrants, as a lot of things. We'd be fools not to, but we don't have to. We don't have a constitutional responsibility. So that's where the powers of the federal government are the greatest, and arguably there is a need for uniformity, or you can make the argument you need uniformity and so forth. When you start getting into medical care policies and so forth, well, why not have, you know, more decentralization, and also not just give states, insurance companies and arrangements, monopolies within states, but let it go across state lines so that people can purchase policies across state lines. There's a strong argument for that. Although it's an argument that says that we're going to undermine state and local autonomy, you see. The people of New York want you to pay for podiatry and for psychological counseling about, you know, whatever else. Neurotic Manhattan people.
Dr. Dogs.
Yeah, right. Your dog psychology. You got to pay for that and have it as part of your policy. Doggy analysis. Somebody's was up to Albany and figured a way to make money on that. We know how those things get into laws. But somebody demands it. So it is a local decision. And one of the things I think Tocqueville would say is when you have local decisions, some of them are going to be stupid. Hayek certainly says that. They're not all going to be smart. Some will be real dumb.
But some will be smart.
And the sum total is going to do things and going to provide ways to improve things better than you can. I mean, the French had a system of a little computer system called the Minitel in the 1980s, and it was going to take over everything and so forth. That thing you got there is not a Minitel, and it wasn't invented by a central authority.
One of the readings was King Numbers by John Randolph, and I think if you go back over that, you'll see how much he takes from de Tocqueville, or how similar. In King Number, he refers to the bare majority and how he's horrified at the notion that precedent, tradition, and law can be overturned by a mere majority appealing to an abstract principle, though that principle is not one that has been set down in tradition. He looks at stability and predictability in matters of economic exchange and social order, and he fears that an impulse of an egalitarian plebiscite might usher in the disorder, the unrest, and the horror of the French Revolution. In short, adding on to what de Tocqueville does, the pursuit of equality and widespread democracy rather than republicanism will destroy American tradition of ordered liberty. Randolph's old republicanism reinforces the notion that the American founding was a revolution not made but averted. And that goes back to what Speaker Gingrich said last week. His work also provides a bridge between Jefferson and Calhoun. I just wanted to make sure that I hope you'll go back and reread that, given the brilliant lecture by Mr. Barone, because I think it'll make a lot more sense now. Let's take another one or two questions. Questions? Cadet Slater.
Well, you were talking about how the vibrant civil society and the religious tradition were really important in maintaining freedom and, I guess, kind of keeping society together at a local level a lot better. Now, I think that played a pivotal role in the peace process right after the Civil War, because those local groups could really, keep everything together, keep a social cohesion. But a lot of times when we're looking at other civil wars that are threatening to kind of relapse back into conflict, the peace process is really just kind of at that macro level. It's just, let's throw some peacekeepers in there. Do you think it should be encouraged that, these local civil societies and local religious communities should be really integrated into that peace process?
That sounds like a really smart question. I'm tempted to start off by asking, with malice towards none, with charity towards all. And Lincoln was addressing the federal government in that, but he was certainly setting a tone after, the most terrifying passage in American oratory, that all the blood shed by slaves shall be paid for. It's fair and just altogether. Whoa. And then he gets right into that.
I would recommend in that connection a book that I've read. I can't remember the title of it, but the author is Drew Faust, who is currently the president of Harvard University. And she is got a Southern background, and she's read a book about the remembrances after the Civil War, the both North and South, the memorials, the amount of people killed. I just refer to 400,000 in World War II, 600,000 in the Civil War in a nation of 38 million, okay? What is that for? What's the equivalent for that in the proportionate nation of today? It's about 4,800,000 people dead. That's a lot. And you go to any little southern town, any little courthouse town, any New England town, and so forth, and you look at the plaque and the numbers of people, and then go look up the census numbers, the 1860 census numbers for that community, and you get an idea of the sort of thing. But I forget the name. I think the word remembrance or something is in the name. It's something you can easily find, but it's a book that addresses this in a very intelligent way, and since I have developed an anti-Harvard prejudice after going there, I have to say that I thought she seems to be a very thorough scholar and a person that writes with great intelligent sympathy for people in all these situations.
We have time for one last question. Gentlemen? Mr. Lacey, go ahead.
Okay, well, mine wasn't so much a specific question, it's just I was curious more on your thoughts with when you brought up education earlier and you spoke about the whole timid and industrious animals type thing and, you know, I guess teaching in the mean and not promoting excellence. And I thought about what I'd heard about education in some other nations that we're trying to compete with our education system and, you know, perhaps trying to emulate them even though those systems seem to be along the same lines of promoting.
Can you please read my book about the demonography of human shadow bosses? We'll have a couple of chapters on that. But anyway, please continue.
Okay. So I'm just interested, I guess, to get more of your thoughts on that, along with, once again, we were talking about de Tocqueville and how he was talking about, oh, there aren't these bonds necessarily, but where these bonds come from. And I'd say that in America, schools provide a lot of those bonds. Like, a lot of people associate it more with their alma mater more than hardly any other organization. So I'm interested just to get more of your thoughts on education.
Okay, well, the education, a couple things. Number one, my thoughts that I expressed here are sort of a précis of thought, the things I was inspired of a book that I wrote called Hard America, Soft America, published in 2005. And Hard America is the portions of American life where you have competition, accountability, and Soft America is where you don't. One of my basic theses is that most Americans aged 6 to 18 lived in soft America, of the progressive public schools, and then from 18 to 30 we live in hard America, in places like the Citadel and selective colleges of all kinds, in the military and private sector endeavors in various ways. And that, I answered, why do we have incompetent 18-year-olds and competent 30-year-olds? We have the most competent 30-year-olds in the world, but we don't have the most competent 18-year-olds, or so I was asserting. So I was trying to answer that. There's an exception to that period right after Sputnik. I was a beneficiary of this. Goes up, and we suddenly decide that we've got to have advanced placement courses and higher ed courses in a lot of public schools, at least where you had, affluent or high IQ kids were in large numbers. The private school that I went to 3 years ahead of Mitt Romney, we certainly had this. And we had, it was very smart kids. I thought they were all a bunch of jerks, but that turned out these are actually smart people. You see people in their adolescence, well, that's their worst. But anyway, so that was it. And school ties, some of the voluntary associations we're talking about. I mean, a lot of this is nurtured by football teams and things, which I think at some level you can say it's just kind of silly. Why do I care whether, my sister, brother-in-law really care whether the University of Michigan beats Michigan State, and it's all the more important to them because they live in Lansing and still have their U of M sticker on their car. But hey, it's a positive thing. It's helped to build an important academic institution of some distinction. So we have all these different things working together, and you have so many worthy institutions that are worthy in one way or another, or many ways, that it's helpful. The French system, by contrast, probably produces, you know, winnows people and produces more excellence. They had a period where all their presidents and prime ministers had gone to this one school, the École Nationale d'Administration, and happened to walk by it one time where one of their installations in Paris left bank. They got a very efficient parking garage in the basement of this historic building in the left bank of Paris. And these people are very confident they're going to run the country. And, you know, you get this.
They do.
They run the biggest private firms, the parastatal firms, and the government. They run it centrally from Paris. We do. New. And Britain, you know, you still have an awful lot concentration of Oxford and Cambridge. I mean, the current, you know, the current prime minister, David Cameron, is Eton and Christchurch. He's one of 17 prime ministers that went to Eton, the same private school. These people basically, they identify each other by saying to somebody, they see, oh, were you at school? It's understood that the only one you could possibly be talking about is Eton. And apparently it's academically a really tough and rigorous school, and David Cameron did well there, and he was at Christ Church at Oxford, like the Marquess of Salisbury was at, and this and that, and so forth. The people that run The Economist are mostly from Magdalen College, Oxford. Little mafias. We have many, many mafias in this country with lots of smart and talented people in lots and lots of them. It's one of our great strengths. And, you know, if you get a leader, you know, we've had, a president who went to Harvard Law School, the previous president went to Harvard Business School, and the leading Republican candidate went to Harvard Business and Harvard Law School. But then, you know, Bill Clinton came from nowhere and went to Georgetown, which was not a top-rated college.
Yes, but he then went to
Yale Law School. And Newt Gingrich came from a dysfunctional family background and attended Emory and Tulane, which again were, you know, they don't hold the position in our society that Oxford and Cambridge did, and nobody would mistake them for that. And yet they both ascended to the top of the political heap and showed, in part through a show of genuine intellect and skill, in the 1990s and against the odds. So there's plenty of room for achievement here. It's not entirely random, but we're not as centralized as Britain and France are that way, and that's probably a good thing.
Well, the insights you've given us are invaluable, and I'm sure they will live with us forever, and I'm sure they'll live with the cadets forever as well. I can't thank you enough. This has been just outstanding. I hope you'll come back again sometime and talk to us. You're always welcome, and I hope you found it enjoyable being here at the Citadel. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a cool time. Every time I see Mitt Romney, he says, oh, Cranbrook. It's the school we both went to.
He wants me to write something positive about him. He's appealing to that cool time.
Next week on